Hello, Dr. Peter Matthews here from the University of Stirling, recording this podcast with Diane Theakston for the module Understanding Social Policy. And we're here to talk about disability and social policy. So in our last podcast, Diane, we talked about the different models of disability and the shift over time from the medical model to the social model of disability. And then now the emergence of postmodern interpretations of disability and the focus again on the impairment, individual's impairment in their agency that's associated with that impairment. And we just ended by just starting to talk about sort of the welfare system and how that interacts with people who are disabled. But just to sort of take a step back then, more broadly, how would you say, what are the links between disability and social policy? Why do we need to talk about the two together?
That's quite a big question. I would say that underneath it all, in the last podcast we touched upon how societal values, we talked about the blind school, for example. And about how societal values have really shaped how disabled people are viewed and expectations and you know, expectations about themselves as well. So the value systems within society, they shape the social policy landscape, if you like. And we can see that with the early developments of the welfare system. So how we were talking about the medical model before. So we can see how the medical model of disability came to really form how social policy was put into place. So we have, for example, the 1913 Deficiency Act, I think it was called, which was trying to categorise people, disabled people, into different boxes, if you like, so that we could sort out where they go in within society. And actually that's where we get a lot of our slang words now, like idiots and imbecile, because they were some of the categories back then. And then it's developed through the, like, say, the latter half of the 20th century, where we have, like, the Beveridge Report, which we'll probably touch upon in the module. And the formation of the welfare state in 1945 onwards.
Which is very much based on the male skilled, able-bodied worker.
Exactly, yes. And the support that does go out is more for people who are in work and become disabled. You tend to find that that's where support goes. And for people who are disabled but haven't entered employment, what tends to happen is that they're segregated off somewhere. So it could be institutions, or it could be, you know, maybe they had the poor house and different forms of really kind of destitute welfare because they had no means of income. So they're all kind of tied up together.
And I suppose you also had the irony as well that with the development of the NHS after 1948 and the improvements in healthcare, through that you had more disabled people in society because the people who might not have otherwise survived childhood were now surviving childhood because of the improvements in healthcare. So you had the number of disabled people in society was growing as well.
Absolutely, yes. And you still have that today because we have an ageing society, but we're not necessarily living healthier. So we have an ageing society, but we have also got an increase of associated impairment rates as well that are increasing. So the same dilemmas, if you like, are still going on since 1945.
And elsewhere in the module, students will have looked at the issues around the ageing population and the data around that, but also Jane Robertson has spoken to students around the dementia as well, and dementia clearly a form of disability.
Yes, and I think this is where, especially in more recent times, I think when the Disability Discrimination Act came out in 1995, it had quite a tight definition of disability, and slowly it's began to be broadened to recognise conditions such as dementia, so that cognitive impairments are starting to be recognised as impairments as well.
Mm.
So I think that's a step forward. And of course that stems from the kind of push from a kind of wheelchair user-centric perspective of disability and the social model that we mentioned.
Yeah.
And one of the consequences of that is that people with cognitive impairments tended to get overlooked as well.
Yeah.
So so there is steps in the right direction.
Yeah.
I think, yeah.
I suppose to link with the previous podcast as well, you talked about how the blind school was, the children were trained to weave baskets, and that was in the past. But even now today, one of the key ways that disabled people are excluded is from the world of work. And as I understand it, unemployment rates are very high among disabled people.
Oh, yes. I think is it twice as likely to be unemployed compared to the non-disabled counterpart.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we touched upon issues around IT access as well, with if you're blind or partially sighted. And actually within the category of disabled people, you're then 6 times more likely not to be employed if you're blind or partially sighted. And of course the reasons behind that, like we were touching upon, are to do with communicational needs have lagged behind the physical access to the environment.
And also just most employers just are not very good at thinking about ways of making the workplace accessible to disabled people.
Absolutely. And I think there's a lack of awareness as well around the types of support that disabled employees can receive. So, for example, there is the Access to Work scheme, which is run by the government, sometimes not well promoted or publicised, which I think is deliberate, but there is assistance there under Access to Work for if, say, a person needs a support worker, or if you need adaptations to the environment of your workplace, or if you need specialist equipment as well, those sorts, or if you need assistance with travel as well. So say the public transport links are not accessible for you to get into work, then you can get taxi travel, for example, to help you. So there are some forms of support there, but sometimes employers aren't aware of that, and then there's also the double tick scheme. Which is interesting. The double tick scheme is if you meet, let me get this right, is it if you meet the basic essential criteria?
Yeah.
Is it? Yes.
Yeah.
Of a application post, you can tick this box if you're disabled to say that you're guaranteed an interview. And there's views about whether that works well or not, because, okay, it gets you an interview and it might get you some practice of doing an interview and getting feedback. But at the end of the day, if the employer is, you know, maybe not aware of the different support that you could get, or is very aware about inclusiveness within the workplace, and perhaps has these attitudinal prejudices already going on in their heads before you walk in the door, then you're not going to get it. So it was kind of pointless you turning up in the first place.
But I suppose there's longer running issues as well. In that you mentioned that the Disability Discrimination Act was passed in 1995, key act in the UK in providing provision for disabled people. Didn't quite implement the social model of disability, but was as near as we could. But even that, the implementation timetable is very long. So while now we might live in a country with, like you mentioned, public transport, we're now all public transport has to be low floor access, accessible. That's only recent. So you don't have to be that old and be disabled to have been massively marginalised in your life and still be experiencing the results of that in terms of poor education outcomes that mean you're not trained and not skilled to apply to get work, and also sort of the earlier exclusion from work might mean that you're not used to doing things like going for interview and that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Yes. I do remember actually some of the training while I was at school was around, this might be quite interesting, but it was around awareness of body language and how you dress as well, because if you think about it, the world is very visual that we're in.
Yeah.
So you could have people going in for interviews who can't see, and they might put their heads on the desk. Yeah. And they can hear you perfectly well, and they don't need to face you, and they don't need to look at you or have eye contact and things like that. So it was about teaching almost like social etiquette, that you don't go in and put your head on the desk, that you try as much as possible to look at the person when you're talking to them.
Just the tape, Diane is looking at me.
Yeah. Things like that, and also just being aware about what you're wearing, and is it smart enough for an interview? You're not in your jogging bottoms and your t-shirt. And,
I suppose then for all these myriad reasons, one of the key ways then that people who are disabled are, why we have to look at social policy and disability, is that a lot of social policy is delivered for disabled people in terms of the welfare benefit system supporting incomes, because the people are excluded from work, in terms of providing housing, in terms of providing an enhanced education. Mm. These are all ways that as you mentioned, the 1913 Act, the social policy has always been linkages there with disability.
Absolutely. And that's why there are, strong connections between disabled people and, say, poverty or disabled people and low incomes, because that's the groups that they tend to occupy because of these barriers. And then, obviously, we had the policies like the spare bedroom tax that came out. And it affected the social housing sector, which, if you're disabled, you're twice as likely to live in the social housing sector, and the reasons behind that is because obviously you're on low incomes, so you can't afford to enter onto the housing ladder in the and buy your own place. There's also challenges about having private rents, because you might not have enough money for deposits, and the rents tend to be higher. So there's all these different barriers. So that's how policies such as that, when they come out, they disproportionately affect disabled people because of the way that it's all structured with inequalities.
And even with that, the example of social housing as well, that's the housing that, for disabled people with, I might not be using the right language here, so correct me if I'm wrong, but more extensive impairments, that's the housing that can be most easily adapted to their needs, because it's owned by a housing association, it's not a private rental accommodation. As I understand it, was sort of grade with these sort of different adaptations that you can get funding for.
You can get adaptations if you're in a private let as well.
Right.
But I think the challenges of that are actually greater, because housing associations and local authority housing, because their ethos, if you like, is to house vulnerable groups, they tend to be more aware and better understanding. I'm not saying that they're great, by the way, but I'm just saying that they've got better understanding of the needs of disabled people, and about how to apply for, minor adaptations, which would be things like handrails, grab rails. Maybe if you have a hearing impairment, you might need a flashing doorbell. Visual impairment, you might need colour contrast, paint work done inside the property. So things like that. So they know to approach, social work and housing departments to get that done. And that's fine within that budget. They're also more clued into how to get major adaptations, which is more structural. So that's, if you needed a ramp put in at the front door, or if you needed a wet floor shower, things like that. So they're more clued into, this is where we go for how to get major adaptations done, and this is where the money comes from and the budget.
Yeah.
With the private, because you're dealing with private landlords, some private landlords are obviously just interested in, you know, making a profit.
Yeah.
Let's be honest.
Yeah.
So,
well, why else would you be a private landlord?
Yeah. So if you're approaching them and saying, you know, I need these adaptations carried out to the property, the landlord needs to give their consent for that to go forward, and this is where it comes unstuck, because they might withhold that, and of course life gets miserable if you're living in that situation.
Yeah.
And the easiest way is just to move on.
Whereas the social housing providers have a duty to provide that support. I understand you've been doing some research on that, sort of how accessible housing is to disabled people. Is there any sort of what were the key findings from that in terms of disabled people getting access to this adapted housing?
Well, I think in a physical sense, surprise, surprise, there's not enough accessible housing. Full stop. There's a chronic shortage of accessible housing. And of course, that comes from, like we were talking about earlier, about the medical model dominating early thinking around policy making. And also that translated into the built environment, because it was all built around the able-bodied male worker as well. So we have a lot of environments which need to be adapted to make them more inclusive. So, of course, a consequence of that is that our housing is not that accessible. So there's a chronic shortage of wheelchair-accessible housing, for example. So that was one of the findings. I think from applicants' experiences, because I was speaking to disabled housing applicants' experiences, and it was only a pilot project, so it was only 5 households that we spoke to. But interestingly enough, the allocation systems, so the way that properties are allocated to people, appear to have barriers inbuilt to the actual process. So some of the allocation systems operate online. You might have heard of the Ed Index. Ed Index. There's also Home Hunt, which is another online system. And it's a system where people log in, they view property adverts, and then they have to bid on the different properties that they're interested for. The issues that were coming up were if people were perhaps elderly and they forgot to bid, because you have to bid each week.
Yeah.
So they maybe forgot to bid each week. If people are unwell, then there's periods of time where they're unable to cope with logging in and bidding on the property and understanding. So that could be for cognitive reasons. So it could be to do with remembering to do it and how to do it. And it could be for physical reasons, if you've got short stay in hospital as well, and different periods of illness, then it's difficult to continually, you know, log in and track where you're up to with your property searches and bid on the properties. And it's very much moving the focus onto, it's the individual's responsibility to look for housing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of shifting that. And one of the other outcomes of it is that people felt like they weren't engaging with the housing staff as much, because it was all kind of shifted towards they had to do all this. And sometimes people just need a wee bit of reassurance, you know, that they're still on the list, that they're not forgotten about, are they doing it right? And just that kind of personal contact. So the positive stories were more, they came out when people were on the points-based system, which was people just fill out one application form and that's them on a waiting list. And then they would phone up now and then just to say, you know, is everything going okay? Am I still on the list? And those or more positive experiences compared to people who were doing the choice-based letting systems. Yeah,
it's really interesting, and boy, not necessarily got time to discuss it here, but there's a really interesting challenge there between, we talked earlier about an independent living, and that is about giving disabled people choices and the ability to make choices in society that non-disabled people can make. And on the face of it, you'd think a system like choice-based lettings, which allows people much more freedom about where they live and the types of property they choose when they rent social housing, would give will help disabled people have this choice. But it seems, just in the very, very small ways in which the system has been implemented, it actually is making the housing less accessible and is actually reducing the choice that people have.
Yes. I think it's got this feel as though they're giving people an illusion that there's more choice, because they're going in, they're looking at all these properties and they're bidding. But in reality, there is no more choice. It's the same number of properties. You can't do anything about it. And people are constrained as well, in terms of, you know, a lot of people, even though there might be an accessible, perfect property at the other side of Scotland, they will not move there because they have all their family support networks nearby. They've perhaps got their social care packages set up in that local authority area. They perhaps work as well, and they've got all their networks there. So why would they move to the other side of Scotland and feel isolated and in a community that they don't know? And they don't have these connections. So really, it's almost like a false choice, isn't it? Because there is no greater choice there.
Yeah.
It's the same number of properties, and a choice-based letting system is not going to magically make a property appear in their area all of a sudden.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people get frustrated. That's what I was picking up as well, is a lot of people are feeling a bit frustrated because they've been bidding for, you know, 2 months, 6 months or whatever, and there's next to nothing that suits their needs. But at the same time, they get penalised if they don't bid.
I think that's a good place just to wrap up our conversation then. I think that leads us well onto much more contemporary developments in social policy and disability.